Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're really unpacking a fascinating story, an ancient one, but with some, well, surprisingly relevant insights about communication, about getting through tough times. We're focusing on when God speaks, lessons from Elijah. We've got some powerful historical accounts here, and our goal really is to explore how people, individuals and communities, figure out messages, find strength when things get chaotic, and kind of respond to these calls for change, using Elijah's pretty dramatic life as our map. We'll look at the history, the people involved, the sometimes really strange ways guidance seemed to show up back then. And ultimately, we want to see, you know, what patterns might resonate for you today.
Exactly. It's not just like retelling an old story. It's more of an exploration for anyone who's maybe dealing with big changes or trying to find some clarity when things feel messy. Or maybe you're just curious about that whole human experience of, you know, finding direction. These old interactions, they really do have some surprisingly modern echoes.
Okay, so to really get what's going on, we need to understand the world Elijah was stepping into. Let's set the scene. Ancient Israel. It's a nation in, well, a pretty serious state of decline, morally, politically. Think about a kingdom that's divided, politically unstable. You've got 38 different rulers over about 200 years. And get this, only five of them were seen as actually governing justly. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't just politics, it was deeper. A societal breakdown. The sources we have actually call it a time of spiritual adultery.
Which is a really strong term.
It is. It meant this fundamental shift in loyalty, turning away from, you know, core values towards more immediate things, desires. And that was really tearing society apart.
Yeah. And what's striking in these texts is that even with all that decay, there's this sense of a guiding presence still trying to engage, trying to call people back to their roots, their principles. That phrase spiritual adultery, it's such a powerful metaphor, isn't it? It's not just about religion, really. It speaks to that tendency we all have, maybe, to shift our focus from what truly sustains us, integrity, maybe community, long-term thinking, towards, I don't know, quick fixes or passing trends. It kind of pushes us to think about our own allegiances today, right? What are we really prioritizing?
And this decline, it really had faces. We need to talk about King Ahab and his queen Jezebel, Ahab. Well, the texts consistently say he did more evil in the eyes of the Lord than any of those before him. He seemed to just shrug off consequences, marry Jezebel, and then, and this is key, under her influence, he ditches the established traditions, the established God for Baal, a storm god, and Asherah, a fertility goddess. He even built a temple for Baal, an Asherah pole, symbols of this cult that involved practices totally against their existing moral code. And okay, maybe he was capable in some ways as a leader, but morally, not so much. He seems trapped by these choices, constantly rejecting advice. The sources kind of paint him as, well, a bit of a complainer, resistant to guidance.
And Jezebel's influence, it wasn't just on him personally. It became the systemic thing, challenging the whole structure of their society. She was a princess from Sidon. Her father's name, Ethbaal, literally means Baal is with him. So her background is clear. She never bought into the traditional Israelite values. In fact, she actively tried to stamp them out, get rid of the prophets who upheld them. She even managed like 850 pagan priests. Her name became notorious, you know. Centuries later, it's used in another ancient text, Revelation, as a symbol for figures leading people astray with harmful ideas.
Wow.
Yeah. She convinced Ahab to build that temple for Baal, which really cemented this huge shift in the nation's identity.
It's a stark lesson in leadership, isn't it? How tolerating destructive influences, even if the leader seems capable otherwise, can just speed up societal decay. Makes you wonder, what subtle things do we maybe tolerate today in our institutions or families that erode core principles? Right. So into this mess, this swirling chaos of idolatry and bad leadership, steps Elijah, a solitary voice. And the texts make it a point of saying Elijah was a human being even as we are. He's relatable, not some mythic hero, but like us. Yet he becomes this crucial messenger. His name even means Yahweh is my God. Mm. And his message for Ahab, it was blunt, devastating, really. He confronts him head on, declares that the God he serves is going to shut off the rain. He says, there will be neither dew nor rain in the next few years except at my word.
And the significance of that, it's huge. You have to remember, Baal was the god they worshipped for rain, for fertility. So Elijah saying no rain, that's a direct hit on Baal's supposed power. It's like a, well, a divine curse aimed right at the false god and the king who promoted him.
A direct challenge.
Absolutely. But here's a key thing the narrative suggests. Even in that severe judgment, there's always an out. A chance offered to rethink things, to reconsider where you're putting your trust. Like a big signpost saying, wrong way, here's the alternative. And Elijah himself. Forget the image of a quiet clergyman. He's portrayed as this figure of, like, fierce conviction. Think Braveheart, maybe, shouting truth to power.
Okay, so that leads us to this really amazing example of specific guidance. After dropping that bombshell about the drought, Elijah gets his next instructions.
Right.
And they are, well, unconventional. The text says, "Leave here, turn eastward, and hide in the Cherith ravine east of the Jordan. You will drink from the brook, and I have directed the ravens to supply you with food there." Ravens. You know, birds that in ancient times were seen as scavengers, kind of greedy. The word to raven literally means to eat greedily.
Right.
And they become as caterers, delivering these, I don't know, little bird snack packs day in, day out. It's incredibly specific guidance in a crisis.
That really hits home for me because it shows how guidance can come from totally unexpected, almost counterintuitive places. I remember once my wife and I, we were thinking about starting a new project, a church actually, way out in Maine.
Yeah.
Which felt like, you know, all the way east for us. And I prayed for something really specific, like a confirmation from scripture with the word east in it, but one I hadn't seen or remembered before, just something unique.
Okay.
About a week later, I'm at this gathering and a woman comes up, hands me a piece of paper and says, "I don't know why, but I felt I should give this to you." And it's this passage from Ezekiel describing a river of God that flows to the eastern region. And as the man went eastward, the word east was in there five times in just 12 verses.
Wow.
And then get this, a week later, someone else, a different person, hands me the exact same passage out of the blue.
No way.
Yeah. It profoundly built my trust in that kind of specific, unexpected guidance. It showed me clarity can arrive in ways you just don't anticipate.
So thinking about that for you, the listener, how do you maybe recognize those specific, maybe unusual cues or opportunities in your own life? Is there some seemingly bizarre instruction or maybe an unexpected provision that might be pointing you down a different road? Oh, so Elijah's hiding out by the brook, getting fed by ravens, but then after a while, the brook dries up.
Right, which on one hand confirms the drought is really happening, just like you said.
Yeah, but it's also a test, isn't it? It mirrors those times in our lives maybe when our usual resources just dwindle, that feeling of spiritual dryness or emotional depletion.
Mm-hmm.
But the story suggests that even when the familiar runs dry, there's still a connection. There's this line from the prophet Isaiah, "See, I have engraved you on the palms of my hands." Like, you know how kids sometimes write an important phone number on their hand so they won't forget? It's that kind of image, a promise of deep personal remembering.
That's a powerful image.
So Elijah's next assignment, it's another step in this refining process. He's sent to Zarephath. And the name Zarephath actually means to melt or smelt, like refining metal.
Interesting, a place of purification.
Exactly. And guess where Zarephath is? It's in Sidon, Jezebel's home turf.
Oh, wow. Deep in enemy territory.
Right, a place where Baal was worshipped heavily, but ironically, even Baal couldn't make it rain there. And there, Elijah meets a widow. And she is in a truly desperate spot. He asks her for some bread, just a small cake. And she tells him, basically, "I only have a tiny bit of flour left, a little oil, just enough to make one last meal for me and my son, and then we're going to die." That's how bad it was. Absolute scarcity.
Just rock bottom.
Yeah. But Elijah, with this, like, incredible confidence, tells her, "Don't be afraid." He says, "Go home, do what you planned. But first, make a small cake for me from what you have. Bring it to me. Then make something for yourself and your son." And then he gives this promise. "For this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. The jar of flour will not be used up, and the jug of oil will not run dry until the day the Lord sends rain on the land."
That's a huge ask. Trust me first, with the very last bit you have.
Right. And the amazing thing is, she does it.
Yeah.
Despite everything, she obeys.
Don't be afraid. It's amazing how often that phrase pops up in these ancient texts, like a core psychological need, right? Facing scarcity, facing the unknown, that need for reassurance. I mentioned this recently about my grandson passing a couple of years back. That sense, that deep internal feeling of don't be afraid, it was a real anchor, even in, you know, the face of death itself. It offered this profound peace. And this story in Zarephath, it really challenges us, I think. What do we put our ultimate faith in that? Well, that ultimately lets us down. Is it money, perfect relationships, that retirement plan we're banking on? We often think, oh, if I just get this, then I'll be secure, I'll have enough.
Yeah, we do that.
But those external things, they often don't deliver that deep, lasting security or fulfillment we're actually searching for. This story pushes us to ask, where does our real provision, our real peace actually come from?
Okay, so the miracle happens, the flour and oil don't run out, but then the story takes another sharp turn from scarcity to just tragedy. The widow's son gets sick, gravely ill, and then he dies.
Oh man, after everything.
Exactly. And in her grief, she turns on Elijah. She says, What do you have against me, man of God? Did you come here just to remind me of my sin and kill my son?
It's
just raw human anguish. You can feel it.
Completely understandable.
But Elijah, instead of getting defensive, he just acts. He asks for the boy, takes the child's body upstairs to his own room, and he cries out to God, not defending himself, but pleading for the boy. Lord, my God, have you brought tragedy even on this widow I'm staying with by causing her son to die? He asks God to let the boy's life return. He even stretches himself out on the boy three times. It's this desperate, visceral plea.
Wow, that's intense.
And the response is,
yeah,
just amazing. The text says the Lord heard Elijah's cry. The boy's life returned to him. He breathes again. Elijah picks him up, takes him downstairs, and presents the living child back to his mother.
Yeah.
An absolutely extraordinary moment.
What really jumps out there is Elijah's motive. His prayer, his plea. It wasn't about saving his own reputation, you know.
Yeah.
It was about the credibility of the message he carried. He wanted this woman living in this culture, steeped in other beliefs, to see, to know that the God he represented was real, involved, caring. It shows how deeply held beliefs often get confirmed through real world events, sometimes dramatic ones like this, sometimes small things like finding your lost keys when you prayed about it. It suggests there's a presence that engages, that responds in big ways and small.
And the confirmation is so clear. The widow's response says it all. Now I know that you are a man of God and that the word of the Lord came from your mouth. It's the truth.
Boom! There it is.
That experience just solidifies everything for her. It shows how sometimes tangible results are what really affirm a deeper truth. Okay, so all of this, the drought, the ravens, the widow, the resurrection, it's all building towards this massive confrontation, the ultimate showdown. God tells Elijah, go present yourself to Ahab, which leads them to Mount Carmel.
Which was a significant place, right?
Hugely significant. It was a known site for Baal worship. And ironically, the altar to the traditional God of Israel that had once been there, it had been torn down.
Setting stage perfectly.
Exactly. Elijah tells Ahab, gather everyone, all of Israel, and bring your 450 prophets of Baal. Then standing before this huge crowd, Elijah throws down this challenge. He says, how long will you waver between two opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal is God, follow him. Stop trying to play both sides.
Make a choice.
Right. And he proposes a test. Two bulls. Prepare them for sacrifice, put them on altars, but don't light the fire. The God who answers by fire, he is God.
High stakes.
Totally. So the prophets of Baal go first. They call on Baal all morning.
Nothing.
We dance, they shout louder, they start cutting themselves with swords and spears, this frantic, desperate ritual.
Trying anything.
Anything. But the text says there was no response, no one answered, no one paid attention. Silence. Elijah even mocks them, famously, shout louder, maybe he's deep in thought or busy or traveling, maybe he's asleep and he's waking up.
Ouch, rubbing it in.
Yeah, still nothing. Then it's Elijah's turn. He takes 12 stones, one for each tribe of Israel, and he repairs the Lord's broken altar, a symbolic act of restoration.
Rebuilding what was torn down.
Then he digs a trench around it. And then he does something that seems completely counterintuitive. He has them pour 12 large jars of water over the sacrifice and the wood. Not once, not twice, but three times.
Soaking everything.
Completely drenched. Water filling the trench. Impossible to light, you'd think.
Setting up an impossible scenario.
Exactly. Then he prays. And it's short, powerful. Lord, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, let it be known today that you are God in Israel, and that I am your servant and have done all these things at your command. Answer me, Lord. Answer me so these people will know you, Lord our God, and that you are turning their hearts back again.
Simple, direct, focus.
And then fire falls from heaven. It consumes everything, the sacrifice, the wood, the stones, the dirt, and it even licks up all the water in the trench. Gone.
Wow. Just consume.
The people's reaction. Instantaneous. They all fall flat on their faces, crying out, the Lord, he is God. The Lord, he is God. Elijah then has the prophets of Baal seized. It's decisive. A turning point.
That 30-second prayer, as you called it, it's incredible, isn't it? And notice the purpose. He spells it out. Let it be known so these people will know that you are turning their hearts back.
Yeah.
It wasn't for his own glory. It was for clarity, for truth, and for the people's redirection. That clarity of purpose, aiming for something bigger than yourself, seems absolutely crucial for seeing those kinds of powerful confirmations, those big shifts.
Yeah.
It's a reminder that when our why is clear and focused on a greater good, the how can be dramatic, undeniable. It can literally change hearts and minds on a massive scale.
So you'd think after that display, game over, right? Mm-hmm. Elijah even announces the drought is ending, tells Ahab rain is coming. He actually runs ahead of Ahab's chariot for like 13 miles to get back before the storm hits.
Incredible energy after all that.
Right. But Ahab gets back, tells Jezebel everything that happened, and they still don't change. In fact, Jezebel doubles down. She sends a message to Elijah saying, basically, by this time tomorrow, you'll be as dead as those prophets you killed.
Unbelievable. No repentance at all.
None. And Elijah, again, a man like us, he hears this threat and he runs. He runs for his life. The fearless prophet is now terrified. He goes a day's journey into the wilderness, sits down under a broom tree, and he's just done, utterly exhausted.
Hits the wall.
Totally. He basically prays to die. I've had enough, Lord. Take my life.
Mm-hmm.
This profound moment of burnout, of losing perspective after such an intense peak, very human.
Absolutely. We've all maybe felt that, even if not quite so dramatic.
But that guiding presence, the one who supposedly has his name engraved on the palms of his hands, doesn't leave him there. God meets him in that despair. The text describes God telling Elijah to go stand on the mountain. And then comes this display of power. A mighty wind that shatters rocks, then an earthquake, then a fire. Dramatic stuff.
The kind of thing you might expect, maybe.
Right. But the text explicitly says God wasn't in the wind, or the earthquake, or the fire. After the fire, there comes a gentle whisper. A quiet, still sound.
Subtle.
And in that quiet, the question, what are you doing here, Elijah? Is a call back to purpose, back to himself. And immediately after that, God reassures him, tells him he's not alone, that there are 7,000 other people in Israel who haven't given in, who haven't bowed to Baal, people who will carry on the work. He wasn't the only one.
That final encounter, it says so much about burnout, resilience, and perspective, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's so easy after big efforts, big victories, or even just long periods of stress to feel completely alone, like you're the only one carrying the weight.
Definitely.
And the story encourages us, I think, to bring everything to that guiding presence, not just the big Mount Carmel moments, but the exhaustion, the fear, the I want to quit moments under the broom tree, whether you feel like you can run or walk or just barely limp towards it.
Mm-hmm.
The message is that there's support. That name is still engraved. You're not forgotten. And guidance, reassurance, it might not come in the earthquake or the fire. It might come in that quiet whisper, that subtle insight after the storm has passed. It suggests vulnerability isn't the end. It can actually be where the deepest connection happens.
What an incredible journey to unpack Elijah's story.
Yeah.
We've seen so many different ways communication or guidance seems to happen here. You know, through direct bold challenges,
right,
through really specific, sometimes bizarre seeming provision like the ravens,
right,
through tangible results that confirm conviction like the oil and flour or the boy coming back to life, through these powerful answers to prayer like the fire on Carmel, and then maybe most intimately in that gentle whisper when you feel completely depleted.
It really highlights how multi-layered guidance can be, doesn't it? It's not just one thing. In this whole narrative, it reminds us that, well, life involves these profound patterns. Resilience is a process. And that sense of being alone, maybe it's not the full picture.
So as you, our listener, think about Elijah's story, how he dealt with leadership, with massive challenges, with his own despair. What insights does it spark for you about communication, resilience, finding your own purpose? What subtle cues, maybe unexpected opportunities, or perhaps quiet, gentle whispers might be present in your life right now? What might they be inviting you to look at more closely, or perhaps a different path? What steps might you take to listen?